Welcome to the Property Lovers Podcast. I'm your host, Dominique Grubisher. This podcast series is all about giving you a competitive edge in your property journey. We'll be discussing little known strategies, tools, and information to help you add value and create wealth through property. Now, obviously, we don't know you or your unique position, so this is not financial or investment advice. It is information of a general nature, and you should always seek professional advice as to your situation before you ever invest in anything. But if you want to play a bigger game in property and want to use property as your vehicle to create wealth and, more importantly, freedom, then you're in the right place. Let's do this. Let's get started.
Let's jump into part two. We're going to look at the war in Ukraine and the economic sanctions part of that, the evolution of the international monetary system, a little focus on Australia, the lucky country, and then some recommendations at the end. And to the extent we've covered a lot of material already, which we have, I won't repeat that, but some of it. I've always studied geopolitics. I got a graduate degree in international economics and went to law school after that and worked in, started my career in Citibank, which was the biggest bank in the world at the time. I like to say I worked there when it was still a bank before Sandy Weill turned it into a hedge fund. But the point is, economics and geopolitics have always had some connection. There's no doubt about that. But they were still separate. Today, they're so densely interconnected that you cannot talk about one without talking about the other. So we're trying to stick to economics and markets. And I know investors are focused on that, but you've got to do the geopolitical landscape. There's just no way to really separate them at this time. Pardon me. So let's jump in. So there's a war in Ukraine, obviously. I don't want to get into the background of that and the geopolitics of it in the sense of, did Russia invade on February 24, 2022? Yes. But was that a preemptive invasion in the sense that they expected Ukrainian forces to attack the Donbas in a couple of days? Good evidence for that. But this has really been brewing since at least 2008. That's when George Bush said that Ukraine and Georgia should become members of NATO. Putin invaded Georgia within months. So that was sort of a sign that he didn't agree. So if you say Ukraine and Georgia are going to be members of NATO and Putin invades Georgia immediately, you're supposed to look at Ukraine and say, maybe Ukraine's not going to be a member of NATO. But the U.S. persisted in that. There were many warnings. The U.S. engineered a U.S. and MI6, CIA and MI6 engineered a coup in Ukraine in 2014. Putin responded by annexing Crimea. So 2008, Ukraine and Georgia are going to join NATO. Putin invades Georgia. 2014, the U.S. and U.K. engineer one of these color revolutions in Ukraine. Putin takes Crimea. You would think the U.S. would get the message, but apparently not. So now we are we're in a full-scale war. But I'll leave the antecedents of that to the historians. Let's just talk about what's going on in the war. The first thing, every war is surrounded by lies and propaganda from both sides, or all sides, I should say. We know that Winston Churchill famously said, In war, the truth is so valuable, it has to be protected by a bodyguard of lies. And that's true. I mean, one understands that. But my job is not to absorb the lies and propaganda. My job is to figure out what's actually going on. And it's not easy. Getting good sourcing, New York Times is pretty much full of lies. I wouldn't rely on the New York Times for anything. But I do read it. I read the New York Times every day. During the Cold War, I used to read Pravda. People say, Jim, why do you read Pravda? It's all lies. And I said, well, that's why. Because when you know what your opponents are lying about, it tells you what they care about. They wouldn't lie about things they don't care about. They lie about things they do care about. So just from the lies alone, you say, well, this must be important to you. And then you can use inferential method and say, well, if you're saying this, but not only is it important, but probably the opposite is closer to the truth. And then you can use what's called all source fusion, using other sources of intelligence to get at something that approximates what is going on, standard intelligence analysis. So I do read the New York Times, even though it's full of lies, because it's nice to know what the CIA is thinking. But that said, the what you hear today is the following. Pardon me, excuse me. Ukraine's on the march. They've made major advances in eastern Ukraine and the area of the Donbass. They've now reoccupied the city of Kherson, which is a major, it's a regional capital. It's also strategically placed. It's on the Dnieper River. Kiev is very far inland. Kiev is, I guess they say, we used to say Kiev. Kiev is very far inland. It's at the end of the, near the navigable part of the Dnieper River. But it's Kiev's access to the Black Sea, and then in turn to the Aegean and the Mediterranean and the rest of the world. So it's a very important trade route. Kherson is on the Dnieper River. If you have Kherson, you can control river traffic. So it's a very important place. Russia withdrew. First, they evacuated civilians, and they withdrew their own troops to the other side of the Dnieper River. Russia has a fortified line on the eastern shore. Ukrainian troops are now on the western bank, again, have taken the city of Kherson. So from this, what do we hear? You know, Russia's in retreat, Russia's in disarray, Putin's hanging by a thread, Ukraine's advancing on all fronts, arms are coming in from Germany, US, UK, Poland, other arms suppliers, et cetera. And Putin's days are numbered. It's just a matter of time before they're out of Ukraine. Everything I just said is a lie. I mean, this is what they tell you, but none of that is true. So let's go back and look at what's actually going on. By the way, there are good sources on this. Some of them are from, you know, journalists. Agence France actually has done a great job of reporting. There's some Swiss observers who previously worked as United Nations peacekeeping forces in Eastern Ukraine. Nasty job. But you get to see, you're there, you get to see what's going on. You have very good sourcing. And there's some US sources as well, intelligence analysts, military analysts who are maybe retired, but still have very good sources in the intelligence community, in the military, who will give them a truthful summary. You gotta really look around, but you can do it. And here's what's actually going on. So first of all, Ukraine did make major advances in the east. That part is true. But they were very lightly fortified. The Russian affiliated troops, some of them were autonomous regional troops, not much more than state police. Russia decided that territory is not worth fighting over. Let's withdraw. Quickly withdrew to much more fortified lines on a line between Donetsk and Luhansk. That's the Russian red line, if you want to think of it that way. So they just withdrew, kind of let Ukraine have it. It wasn't important to them. For Russia, a strategic position and a long-term plan are much more important than square miles or, you know, square inches on a map. That territory is flat, open. It's a killing field. When the time comes, and it's already here, but coming sooner than later, it'll be a slaughterhouse for Ukrainian forces. Going over to Kherson, which I already mentioned, that's in more central, well, it's on the Dnieper River in central Ukraine, but closer to the western half. That was what you call salient. A salient is when you have a line, but there's one part that kind of sticks out. That stuck out from the main Russian line. Could Russia have defended it to the point of, you know, kind of practically destroying Kherson? Probably, but the Russian general, they call him General Armageddon, is his nickname, said, why? Why do we want to fight over that now? Why don't we just withdraw to a sustainable line, let them have it, come in, wave the flag? And they did. The Ukrainians didn't rush in because they thought it was a Russian trap. It wasn't. It'll end badly for them, but they were very cautious about going in because they didn't know what they would encounter. What they encountered was nothing. They reoccupied the city. But for Russia, it was giving up territory that they did, a city they didn't really care about. They're still on the eastern shore. They still control the river traffic. They have their fortified lines, and they weren't giving up much by giving up that city. And again, Ukraine gets to wave the flag. So what's actually going on with the Russian army? They have mobilized 300,000 troops. That's 20 divisions. I mean, that's several armies. They've done it gradually. The forces that were already in Ukraine were not their best troops, but they fought well enough, but they've been able to rest. These 300,000, 180,000 of the reinforcements are already there. The rest are on their way. They've got better leadership, a little bit of trial and error. Russia, you know, did a few things wrong, but they learned quickly. these troops have been resupplied, more ammunition, more weapons, Turkish drones, Iranian drones, very important. They've restocked their cruise missiles. They've got, as I said, food, ammunition. They've been able to rest and prepare. They're in combat formations and they're ready to roll. When will they roll? They got to wait for really cold weather, not just a couple cold nights, but a sustained period of cold weather for the ground to harden. They're going to use armored personnel carriers, tanks, artillery that rolls, either towed or mobile artillery. You don't want to be driving around the mud and that stuff. I have a farm in the country and it's on a dirt road, and I know what it is to be up to your axles in mud. They don't want that. They're going to wait till it freezes. So mid-December, January, I don't know the exact date. I don't have their battle plan, but you can see it coming. And there's, as I say, good sourcing on this. When, by the way, there's not much left of the Ukrainian armed forces. About 30,000 Ukrainian troops are actually Polish troops in Ukrainian uniforms. All right, so they got Ukrainian insignia. It's not technically a NATO-Russia confrontation. Heaven help us if it is, because that could lead quickly to nuclear war. But it is the Ukrainian armed forces have been substantially reduced. There's not much left of them. What about all the fancy weapons the United States is sending in and others? Yeah, first of all, very difficult to get them there. It's one thing to move it from the Polish border into Ukraine. It's another thing to get it from Western Ukraine to Eastern Ukraine, where the battlefield is. By the way, that's a distance of almost 1,000 miles. So Ukraine's the largest country in Europe. They're running out of fuel. You got to take by locomotive. You don't have diesel fuel to run the locomotives. The tracks have been blown up. Power grid's been blown up. And they get them there. The troops can't read English, haven't been trained. There are some CIA and other instructors there in, kind of civilian garb, but you can't teach that many people that quickly to work that many weapons. And they very quickly get blown up by the Russians, or they run out of ammunition, or they get sold in the black market. So there's a lot less there than meets the eye. When I said MI6 blew up, not MI6, British Special Forces, military forces blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. We already talked about that, but that was critical infrastructure. They blew up the Kerch Bridge that connects Crimea to Russian territory. Crimea is Russian territory as far as the Russians are concerned, but Crimea is a sort of peninsula, and there's a mainland, there's a bridge that connects the two. The Kerch Bridge, that was blown up. So at that point, Putin said, okay, gloves are off, infrastructure's fair game. He is systematically degrading the electrical infrastructure of the rest of Ukraine, not the part he controls, which again, they consider Russian territory today, but the western part of the country and the area around Kiev. Those people are in the dark. They're freezing in the dark right now. So not only are they freezing in the dark, but they can't get fuel to replenish what they have to run generators. There are a few generators working, intermittent power here and there. But you need diesel to run the generators, and they can't get the diesel because the trains don't work, so it's really going down fast. So what we look for is a massive Russian offensive, or maybe at this point a counteroffensive, given some Ukrainian gains, coming soon, mid-December, maybe at the earliest, January at the latest, once the ground freezes. They're going to roll up the rest of the country. Ukraine should have avoided the war in the first place. They could have had a peace treaty fairly early on. They could still have one now. They're not getting their land back. Too bad. I mean, if you wanted that, you should have avoided the war in the first place by agreeing not to join NATO and giving the Donbass some autonomy. That opportunity was missed. By the way, Zelensky is pretty much of a puppet. He'll be gone soon. He made the mistake of believing Biden, talked to the Afghanis about believing Biden. He turned his back on them, separate issue. But Biden's a thug and doesn't care about anything other than the Biden crime family. So the Ukrainians are going to find out the hard way. You can't rely on Biden. And the US and UK have their own reasons for continuing this war, having to do with trying to overthrow Putin. That's delusional. It's not going to happen. But that's kind of how they think. And so the war is going to get a lot worse, and it's Russia's going to roll up the rest of Ukraine. There will be a rump state, not much left. But what does this mean? So that's the military picture, and Russia will control the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea. They'll take Odessa, and then Ukraine can have, you know, whatever's left. What does this mean in terms of the economy and financial sanctions? Now, Biden has said that the sanctions will remain in place as long as Russia is in Ukraine. Russia is not leaving Ukraine ever. So that means that the sanctions will be in place forever. Now, that's not literally true, but this could go on for a very long period of time. This could go on for years. Europe made a lot of bets in the spring of 2022 that the war would be over in 6 months. So we don't really have to worry about the winter of 2023 because it'll be over by the fall. Well, fall's come and gone. Winter's here. Winter's coming, as they say in the Game of Thrones, I guess. So that was a bad bet. And now Europe's back is to the wall from an energy perspective. But everything's going to get worse. Now, the sanctions, I teach financial warfare at the U.S. Army War College. I teach a seminar in the Advanced Strategic Arts Program, my class, very small group, 12, 13 participants, seminar style, mid-career officers, all branches. It's at the U.S. Army War College. But we'll have, in my last class, I had a Navy commander, an Air Force fighter pilot, a couple of Marine lieutenant colonels, an Army colonel who ran an artillery brigade. She was very, very capable, very interesting. But these are the top mid-career people handpicked. They're the future four-star generals, the future national security advisors. And they go through this class. And I teach the financial warfare module. And I told them, the last time I did this was early April. And I told them, I said, these sanctions are not going to work. The people in charge, specifically Yellen, but also Wally Adeyemo, the deputy secretary of the treasury, he's like the sanctions king. So they're not going to work. These people do not understand economics. They do not understand global markets. They know how to slap on sanctions. They're good at that. They have the law behind them. But not only will they not work, they'll backfire. They'll hurt the United States and Europe more than they hurt Russia. My class is very skeptical, and I was fine with that. The seminars are supposed to be give and take. And, I don't blame them for being gung ho, but I said, you know, we'll see you next year and we'll see how it worked out. Well, the answer is it's played out exactly as I told the class in April. Russia has barely suffered. Remember Biden was going to destroy the Russian ruble. Well, the Russian ruble did dip and then bounced right back. And today it's stronger. The Russian ruble is stronger measured in US dollars than it was before the war. It was so strong that Lavrov Navalny, who's the head of the Central Bank of Russia, recently had to cut interest rates, not raise them, but cut them, because she was worried that the ruble was getting too strong. So much for that idea. Russian energy sales are increasing. They're above 2021 levels. Whatever Europe doesn't want to buy, China and India will buy. So there's oil, there's some discounts and revenue takes a little bit of a hit. And there's some transportation logistics and have to jump through a couple insurance hoops. But all these things, they're easy to get around. If you know anything about insurance, you just have a captive insurance company or you self-insure or find someone who will. But, you'll end up destroying Lloyd's of London before you destroy Russian oil exports. And that's kind of the point. Oligarchs, have they lost, townhouses in Belgravia and yachts? Yeah, they have. But what the Americans don't understand is that Putin hates the oligarchs. Putin should send a handwritten thank you note to Biden and say, thank you for destroying the oligarchs. Putin wouldn't do it himself. What he did, he put a few of them in jail, Khodorkovsky and others, and said, you can keep your billions of dollars, but don't mess in politics. That was the message. The oligarchs got the message, had their townhouses and their yachts, but didn't interfere in politics. But Putin actually wanted to get rid of them if he could. He just couldn't. They did have some power in the system. And there's a lot of corruption in Russia, obviously, it goes without saying. But now the U.S. is destroying the oligarchs for him. They're seizing the yachts, seizing the townhouses, freezing the bank accounts, et cetera. So again, Putin's very grateful. Putin's sources of strength, by the way, are the military, the intelligence community, the Orthodox Church, and everyday Russians. Those are the pillars of strength, not oligarchs. So that base, military intelligence, Orthodox Church, and everyday Russians is as strong as ever. Putin's position is secure. So Meanwhile, what's going on in the West? Well, we already talked about this. I don't have to repeat it all, but energy prices are skyrocketing. Economies are heading into recession. Germans will be sleeping in sleeping bags this winter and worse. So, and by the way, Russia hasn't even come close to applying maximum pressure. Obviously, you know, it's tragic. There are some civilian casualties. Russia is systematically degrading the infrastructure of Ukraine, but there's a lot more they can do. So the U.S. has overused its sanctions. This will have an impact, by the way, on my next topic, which is the evolution of the international monetary system. Typical U.S. eggheads, they know economics, they know economic theory, they know the law, they know sanctions, they don't understand how economies actually work and how this has all backfired to the detriment of the West, and it's going to get worse. Let me pivot now to the evolution of the international monetary system, because that's related to the topic we just covered. You hear a lot about the Great Reset, the demise of the dollar will be overthrown as a global reserve currency, new things are coming, and people throw in Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies or whatever for good measure. Some of that's going on, some of it's not. So let's sort of drill down on that, because obviously it's very important to a major trading partner like Australia that has, cares a lot about the role of the US dollar, among other things. In analyzing this, you have to distinguish between the role of a reserve currency and a payment currency. They're two different things. The US is about 60%, actually 59% right now, of global reserves. Now that is down. In 2000, that number was about 70%. Now it's 59%. So that's a significant drop, but it's still dominant. But the euro is about 30%. So the US dollar and the euro combined are almost 90%, not quite, of global reserves, number one. Everybody else has a slice. So, Australia, Canada, sterling, yen, Chinese yuan, they all have a little slice, but they're all kind of squished into that 10% wedge. It's really the US dollar and the euro and predominantly the US dollar. And by the way, when we say the global reserve currency, that it's not really a currency. And here's what I mean. It's not as if the People's Bank of China has $1 trillion and $100 bills stacked on pallets in the basement of the building, basement of their headquarters. It's not actually, you don't actually have the currency. You have securities denominated in the currency. So China does have over $1 trillion of US Treasury bills, notes, and bonds, but they don't actually have dollars the way you would have it in a bank account. They have securities. So the key to reserve currency status is, it's partly the currency, it's based on a currency, but it's your securities market. Do you have a big, liquid, well-regulated, well-supported securities market big enough to hold the reserves? And that's what makes the dollar the top reserve currency. The US Treasury market, there's nothing like it in the world. It's the biggest by far. It's the most liquid. What are the chances that some other currency is going to have a securities market big enough to support global savings and displace the dollar as US reserve currency? Right now, extremely low. The closest, of course, I mentioned the euro, but even the euro, that's not a bond market. There is no European-wide bond market guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the entire European monetary zone. It doesn't exist. You have German bonds, Italian bonds, Spanish bonds, French bonds. Yeah, knock yourself out. You can buy those. And of course, the predominant one would be German bonds, the Bunds, and other Schatzes and other German government securities. But even that is only a slice of the euro. I said the euro is 29%. Well, yeah, but you got to break it into all these different countries. So there's nothing like the US dollar. Chinese yuan, no way. Russian ruble, no way. I've actually met with Australian finance ministry and encouraged them to actually spend more money and try to increase the Australian bond market, because Australia has a lot of good features, including a good rule of law, but they haven't done that. So what's special about the US government bond market? Well, it's not just, first of all, you have to have bonds in all maturities, 30-day bills, 2-year notes, 5-year notes, 7-year notes, 10-year notes, 20-year notes, 30-year bonds, all across different maturities. You need a dealer network. In the US, we have primary dealers who basically underwrite auctions of US Treasury securities. You need settlement and clearance, when issue trading, futures, options, repos, reverse repos, relations with the central bank, settlement, clearance, rule, et cetera. And the biggest one is the rule of law. So you need all of that. It's a huge infrastructure. It would take at least 10 years to build if you started today, and no one has anything like it. China doesn't even come close. And by the way, with China and Russia, the one thing they're missing, and this would be true in a lot of parts of the world, is the rule of law. Even if you had the infrastructure I just described, which is not easy and would take 10 years or longer to build. By the way, the U.S. started building this in 1791. I mean, Alexander Hamilton invented the U.S. government securities market. It's been going strong ever since. So we've been doing this for 230 years. But China lacks the rule of law, not even close to what I'm describing. So it's not going to be very easy to overthrow the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency. But a payment currency is different. Anything can be a payment currency. As I said, you know, when we were kids, we used to trade baseball cards and bottle caps. I'm willing to part with it, and you're willing to accept it and exchange your goods and services, it can be a payment currency. There's a lot going on, and that is a more direct threat to the dollar. So specifically, we have the BRICS, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, but they've now styled themselves BRICS Plus. So when they have their annual summit meetings, and they have other committees and subgroups that meet more frequently, they invite a lot of other countries, Iran, Turkey, Chile, Malaysia, their Central Asian republics, et cetera, are showing up at the BRICS meetings. They're now called BRICS Plus. They are working on a new payment currency. Preliminary indications would be that it would be a new currency, basically invented from thin air. It would be keyed to a commodity basket. It would have some dollar equivalent, and they would accept it as payment from each other. And then it can go on from there. Who knows? Maybe there'll be some bonds issued sooner than later in that currency. But they're encountering a problem, and it's the same problem John Maynard Keynes encountered at Bretton Woods in 1944, because Keynes had the same idea. His global currency was called the Bancor, B-A-N-C-O-R. It was going to be key to a basket of commodities. But commodities are not quite as generic or homogeneous as people imagine. I mentioned oil. There's 72 kinds of oil, corn, wheat. Yeah, all kinds of different grades, different regions. What if it rots in the cargo hold, et cetera? Even those things don't have as much uniformity as one would expect. And this is why you get to gold, because gold actually is uniform. Gold is an element. It's not a compound. It's not a molecule. It's an atom. Atomic number 79. It's gold or it's not gold, but there aren't 72 grades of gold. It's just gold. And so it's not that gold is shiny and pretty, or you wear it on your hand or whatever. It's that it really is very practical if you're trying to create a monetary standard. In fact, gold isn't good for much except money. I happen to think it's the best form of money, but it's not good for anything else, like coding a space helmet. Okay, good, but not much. So Keynes got to gold. Everyone thinks Keynes trashed gold, but he didn't. One of his last papers, he said, I've thought about some more, and commodity standard maybe, but really a gold standard is the way to go. And the only difference between the U.S. and Keynes and the U.K. was that Keynes wanted a global currency that would be new and for everybody, and the U.S. said, no, it's got to be the U.S. dollar. The U.S. won that debate. But as the BRICS Plus go through the same analysis, the same exercise, my view, they're going to end up at gold, but they're not there yet. But they are working on this commodity basket-based currency. There's another group called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. China and Russia are the lead members, but there are a number of Central Asian republics, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and others who are members. They're also inviting other people into the club. I believe Pakistan showed up at their last meeting, and Iran. There are different countries that have applied for membership. They're also working on a new global multilateral payment currency. And then finally, there's a group called the Eurasian Economic Union, not the EU, but the EEU, the Eurasian Economic Union. Again, Russia and some Central Asian, Eastern European republics are members of that. They're working on a currency. And then, of course, we've got the whole world of cryptocurrencies, which we'll talk about in a second. So these efforts are underway. By the way, is there one common denominator among the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS Plus, and the European Eurasian Economic Union. Yes, it's Russia. Russia is a member of all three. So, you know, keep your eye on them. But what is, as I say, it's much easier to create a permanent currency. It could be crypto. It could be encrypted, digitally based. It could be a new G coin, a Putin coin, call it whatever you want. And you could start using it for payments and trade immediately, whether it's a reserve currency or not. And then settle up, you know, four times a year, maybe in gold. So I run a surplus with you, or you run a surplus with me, or a couple times a year, we say, okay, let's square the books. Let's settle up. And this currency could be linked to gold, and we would settle with a physical delivery of gold, or just changing title in a Swiss vault, you know, et cetera. But the point is, if you have to pay gross in gold, so everything I buy from you and everything you buy from me has to be in gold, probably not enough gold for that, unless you took the price to $20,000 an ounce, it'll get there. But if you're doing it on a net basis, so I don't have to pay you gross and vice versa, we just settle up on net, you need a lot less gold and it's much more feasible. So it does seem the system is heading in that direction. So I would not look for the dollar to be overthrown as the global reserve currency quite so soon, as some people expect, but the fact that it could be displaced as a payment currency, that is happening very quickly. Along the lines I mentioned, and that eventually could lead to, as I say, a big enough bond market to start to overthrow the dollar as a global reserve currency. There's something else going on in the space, which I don't want to spend a lot of time on, but just briefly, central bank digital currencies, CBDCs. These are not cryptocurrencies. It's not a blockchain. It's not decentralized. These are issued by central banks. There is a ledger. There's an encrypted digital ledger, but it's not blockchain technology. Better, faster, cheaper. Yeah, like if I go buy a candy bar at a newsstand in an airport, I use a credit card. The retailer now has a credit card receivable. He sells it to what's called a merchant acquirer. They bundle up a whole bunch of credit card receivables, about hundreds of millions. Deliver them to MasterCard or Visa. MasterCard or Visa pays them. And then MasterCard or Visa sends the receivable to the bank that issued the card, and they send me a bill and I pay it. But think about it. One candy bar, you got five parties, me, the retailer, the merchant acquirer, MasterCard, and the bank. And like 2.5-3% fees and five steps. It's very clunky, very expensive, relatively inefficient, even though I got the candy bar. The central bank digital currency, you can cut out all the intermediaries. I could have an account at the Fed. Right now, you have to be a member of the Federal Reserve System, big bank, basically. I could have an account at the Fed. I could have my little Samsung or iPhone, you know, with a QR code, and I could pay you just by sending you the money, and it would show up in your Fed account, or Reserve Bank of Australia could do the same thing, of course, cut out all the intermediaries. Now, I don't think they actually will cut out the intermediaries, because the job of central banks is not to help economies, it's to help banks. They don't admit that, but that's what they're there for. So they won't get rid of the banks, but this could be better, faster, cheaper, more efficient. That is true. And that's demonstrable. And these are in pilot programs all over the world. So what's not to like? Well, this is the final step in the totalitarian surveillance state. This is the realization of the neo-fascist impulse. We see in New York, you see it in Victoria, New South Wales. It's all over the world. With the central bank digital currency, you're under constant surveillance. Now, they already know where you are from your iPhone. Turn it off. They still know. Stick it in a Faraday sack. Okay, maybe you got a little cut down the radiation. You got a little protection there. But with the central bank digital currency, I'm buying, let's say I'm not in a candy, buying candy bar, say I'm buying a book. You're under surveillance at the point of purchase. They know what book I bought. If it's like, you know, Why I Love Ron DeSantis, you know, Biden might send the FBI and break down my door. The point is they can impose negative interest rates. That's hard to do if you have a cash alternative. Along with the central bank digital currency, they're going to get rid of cash. That's already happening. And you have to, because if people don't like central bank digital currencies, they can just go to cash. It's clunky, you got to hide it in the backyard or whatever, but it's an alternative. So you have to get rid of cash at the same time you're pushing the central bank digital currencies. But once you do, you've got your entire citizenry under total surveillance. You can move quickly to a social credit score, which we already have in China, but welcome to communist China if you're in Sydney or Chicago. and that you give a political contribution to the wrong party, buy a book with the wrong thoughts. Now, the thought police are active through computers and artificial intelligence and knowing exactly what you bought. Negative interest rates, you know, withholding taxes. Like, hey, I work for a living, I get paid, they take out withholding tax. They do if you're working for a wage, even if you make a lot of money, that's what happens. But what if you're a doctor, a lawyer, a consultant, a dentist, an independent business owner, a writer who gets royalties, et cetera, you don't have withholding taxes. You got to pay your taxes on, you know, voluntarily on a periodic basis. You know, and most people do, but now the government can say, well, we don't like that system and we don't really trust you. So we're just going to withhold it from your bank account. You can do that. Then you file your tax return and we'll talk about it. We'll reconcile it, you know, after the end of the year. But it's more that the thought police, the surveillance, identifying political enemies, weaponizing law enforcement. The US FBI is kind of a Gestapo for the Biden administration. All that's going on already. Again, I say things like this, people roll their eyes. That'll never happen. It's happening. Just, you know, look at the headlines. But the central bank digital currency will be the final step in that. So what will people do? People are amazingly creative and adaptive when it comes to creating new forms of money. I remember when I was a kid, you know, there'd always be a great uncle or somebody around and say, hey, kid, don't take any wooden nickels. And I was like, what's a wooden nickel? Well, during the Great Depression in the United States, we had wooden nickels. There was so little money, so much unemployment, so many business shutting down. Towns and communities created wooden money. They put a little stamp of the name of the town on it, and citizens would accept it and pass it among themselves. They were creating their own money supply to deal with the fact that there wasn't enough. It's called dollars, the regular money. So people are adaptive. So if you don't like central bank digital currencies, and I don't because I don't buy into fascism, and cash is gone, which it may be, probably will be. You should get gold and silver, you know, silver dollar, a 1 ounce. We have American silver eagles. I know the Perth Mint and other sources in Australia have 1 ounce silver coins, you know, pure silver. They're very practical. 1 ounce gold coin, it's a nice store of wealth, but that's, you know, like a couple thousand bucks. That's a lot of groceries. It's probably too much for transactions. The ideal gold coin is a quarter ounce or 8 grams, which is almost exactly the weight of the British sovereign, which until 1914 was money. If you were going around the world, you took a sack of a purse of British sovereigns and you got off the boat in Bombay at the time, today Mumbai, and that was money. Well, we can go back to that fairly quickly. So as the central bank digital currency emerges, as cash is withdrawn, expect citizens to go to 1 ounce silver coins and quarter ounce or 8 gram gold coins so that you can have what Bitcoin promises but doesn't deliver, which is anonymity and freedom. Crypto, I won't spend a lot of time on. I'm not a big fan, but of course we're all familiar with the FTX situation. You read the headlines, so you know about that, but here's the point. So it looks like a $10 billion fraud. People compare it to Bernie Madoff. This is much bigger than Bernie Madoff. We're already seeing things like that don't happen. I've lived through a number of them in other asset classes like money. But when they happen, there's a sequential collapse. Remember 2008, September 15th, 2008, Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. It was a Sunday, by the way. It was close to midnight on a Sunday. You could file electronically. The computers were open. And then the whole world kind of fell apart beginning the next morning. You could see that coming a year away. That's really started in the summer of 2007, not 2007, not 2008. It started a year before. Same thing with long-term capital in 1998. That started in Thailand in 1997. So you can see these things coming in advance. There were plenty of warning signs about FTX, but now we're going to see the sequential collapse. Remember what happened in 2008? March 2008, Bear Stearns collapsed. June 2008, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac collapsed. And then September came Lehman Brothers. But so right now, one crypto exchange after another are failing. They're filing for bankruptcy. Why? Well, either they loan money to FTX and that's a bad debt. Now they're out of money, or they use FTX as a custodian. They put their cryptocurrencies with FTX. FTX is gone. So now they don't have assets. They're getting a run on the bank. this is already collapsing. It's going to get a lot worse, and crypto prices are going down. They just kind of know they're there. I've never been a fan. But people go, oh, Jim, you're a dinosaur. You don't understand technology. No, I read Satoshi Nakamoto's paper very shortly after it came out. I'm very good at math. I understand the algorithms. I also know that the coders and developers and mathematicians who invented this stuff don't know anything about money. They know a lot about computers, but they don't understand how monetary systems work. But that's okay. They're finding out the hard way. Here's the big question. So there's a collapse in the crypto ecosystem, sequential collapses of exchanges. Will that leach into the real monetary system, banks, hedge funds, institutional investors, et cetera, and start to look like 2008 or 2020 or worse? The answer is yes, but recall when we talked about the global financial crisis, that's happening anyway. We're looking at a global liquidity crisis and a global financial collapse anyway, even without FTX. So FTX now acts as what in the military we call a force multiplier, which is takes your existing forces and amplifies it. So we could be looking at in my view, a global liquidity crisis now with a force multiplier coming out of the crypto world. So that'll just make everything worse. So get out of crypto. I've never advised going into crypto. I've never owned any, don't care to. But if you are, get out while the getting's good, because that's going to get a lot worse. And just to kind of sum up the segment, I've always said the world cannot destroy the US dollar, but we may do it ourselves. We, the United States, will do it ourselves. And we're doing a pretty good job of it right now. So let me just kind of pivot to Australia, our audience, and again, a country I love and been to many times. It's called the lucky country for a reason. Relatively small population, but human capital is high, well-educated, productive workforce, you know, untold natural resources, big trading relationship with China and with the rest of the world, high tech. So Australia has everything going forward. And as I say, one mild recession in 28 years, nice going. So you live up to your name. Right now, growth is about 3.6% annualized, which is very healthy, a lot better than the United States and Europe and Japan and other countries I mentioned that are going into recession. The RBA has raised its cash rate to 2.85%, the latest in a series of increases, but still not nearly as high as the United States. Inflation is about 7.3%, most recent data. That is high, but the RBA is on a mission to bring it down, as is the case with the Federal Reserve, and they go long enough, they might succeed. Commodity prices have been strong. So Australia looks like it's running on all cylinders, and it's doing a lot better than the rest of the world. There's no question about that. What could cause difficulties for Australia? And I do expect this. Number one, I expect a commodity price collapse. Now we're in inflation right now. I get it. I put gas in my car, but if the recession and the financial crisis globally are as bad as I'm describing, and I believe they will, they are, commodity prices are going to collapse, and it's going to hurt Australia's revenues and hurt Australia's GDP, and we'll be in a recession. And Australia can't escape a global recession. They can escape. They do a pretty good job of avoiding recession on their own. But if you're a trading nation, which Australia is, and I mean, there's a lot of internal consumption and, as I say, human capital in Australia. But if you're a trading power, or you rely on exports, which Australia does to some extent, including agricultural exports, if there's a global recession, you're not going to be able to avoid it. And particularly with China, where China's your largest trading partner, and China's in as bad shape as I've described, then that's obviously going to bounce back and hurt Australia. So Chinese trade will shrink, and Australia will be a victim. You're also going to get less direct foreign investment from China. China's got capital controls. Last time I was in Melbourne, somebody said the national bird of Australia is the crane, because there were construction cranes all over the horizon. Fair enough, and very robust real estate market, but a lot of that was driven by Chinese capital, and those capital outflows are going to dry up. And also not optimistic when I see how the Australian people accepted the neo-fascist approach in Victoria and New South Wales and elsewhere around the country. You had quarantine, you had COVID concentration camps, I call them, the vaccine mandates. The vaccines don't work. As I say, they're not vaccines. They don't prevent infection. They don't prevent the spread. They're experimental gene modification techniques. Take it or leave it. The fact that you would lose your job or be, kicked out of public service or kicked out of the military or suffer other grave career threatening consequences because you wouldn't take an experimental gene modification therapy. There should have been more of a pushback to that. There was in some parts of the United States, Florida, South Dakota, and some other countries. The U.S. has a federal system, so we've got 50 different, slightly different results. But there was a lot of pushback, even in the face of places like New York and California that were going the fastest route. But I was, a little discouraged to see Australians going along with this. It's a bad model for the future. But that aside, Australia will experience a downturn because you're very dependent on China. That's not a bad thing. It's just the case. And China is in very severe distress, and so is the U.S. and Japan. So I'll finish there.
If you're part of our property lovers community and you're really enjoying this podcast, then leave us a review below and tell us where you're listening in from and what you'd like to know more about. If you're enjoying this podcast, we want to invite you to join the Property Lovers Facebook group. To find the group in Facebook, just search for Property Lovers. You'll see the group banner, which has the word Property Lovers Hub on it. It's a community for property lovers in Australia. And just like this podcast, it's been created to give you a competitive advantage so you can get superior results in property. Please come and join us today. That's it for today, but really looking forward to giving you more tools, more strategies, more support, and a competitive advantage when it comes to property in our next episode.